Avoiding Armageddon requires constant vigilance. This is Western Worlds. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissey, speaking to you from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Asteroids, comets, and other small bodies have always fascinated those who watch the sky. With many large objects making it through the atmosphere, identifying and understanding these objects has become more important than ever. We talked to Carrie Nugent of Caltech IPAC, who works at JPL on the WISE and NEOWISE asteroid hunting missions, to find out what the latest research into our closest neighbours has uncovered. Let's go to the interview.
Welcome to Western Worlds.
It's great to be here.
And I'm happy to talk to you. Your métier is in asteroids.
Yes.
What do you do with them?
All asteroids all the time here.
Mm-hmm.
So the main interest I have is finding them, also figuring out how big they are and what they're made out of. Very basic questions.
Okay. And so how big are they?
Great question. They're all over the place in terms of size. There are asteroids that reside in the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. The biggest ones there have surface areas comparable to, say, Pakistan. And then they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And there's not really a hard cutoff of what the smallest asteroid can be. Certainly the smallest discovered ones are in the neighborhood of a couple meters across.
Okay. And I guess anything smaller than that probably is existent, but hard to find.
Yeah, certainly hard to find with telescopes. And you can think of it going all the way down to things the size of a pea that you see in meteor showers.
Mm-hmm.
There's just kind of a whole gradient. And we think that, you know, the smaller you get, the more of them there are.
Right.
But it is this whole continuum of sizes.
And the other detail you said was, what are they made of?
Yes. Mostly rock, we think. There's a couple that are made out of metal. And different types of rock, people will study the different types of rock that they can be composed of. But mainly the work I do tries to differentiate between which ones are really rocky and which ones are really metallic. And then there's some rocky ones that are just solid chunks of rock. And there's other rocky ones that are called rubble piles, which is kind of a descriptive title. But they're, you know, chunks of rock that are kind of loosely held together with lots of dust. So the work I do tries to distinguish between those three very broad categories.
Okay. Those rubble piles are interesting. You say they're held together. Is it just by gravity? Or?
Just by gravity. They're super weird. They'd be super weird to walk on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of electrostatic forces that are in play there because gravity is so, so weak that your electrostatic forces are relatively more strong. So they're interesting, and they seem to be very common as well.
That is interesting. No, you say common. How many asteroids are we talking about? There's at least 6 or 7.
Asteroids total? I actually happen to have the number in front of me. As far as near-Earth objects, the objects that get close to Earth, the current number known is 16,190. And the total number of minor planets, this is near-Earth objects, asteroids, comets, is 729,626. And these numbers are all on minorplanetcenter.net, which is the authority for these sorts of things. They keep track of every single one so that anytime somebody can just go there and look up the number and see how many we know about.
729,000 and more.
Yes.
As of today.
As of today. And tomorrow that'll be wrong because we're going to find some more tonight, which is pretty great.
Do we? Or do we find them on a daily basis?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Total number of asteroids goes up all the time.
Okay. It has to be monotonic.
Yes. I mean, ideally, we would like to find them all,
mm-hmm.
At least all of them over a certain size. That's something that could be done within our lifetimes, which would be pretty awesome, but we'll see.
How many do we think are still to find?
Well, you have to break it down in terms of size, mm-hmm. obviously. So the last time the study was done on this, which was in 2012, there was a determination that over 90% of the near-Earth objects greater than 1 kilometer across had been found. That object has gone up in the last couple of years, but not by a whole lot. Mm. And that same study pegged the number of 140-meter or bigger asteroids, that's kind of 140 meters across, says about 30% have been discovered. And that has also gone up since then. But those are kind of the best, closest numbers we have.
Okay. So there's quite a few yet to be discovered.
Yes. It would be really great to find all of the, you know, asteroids of that size, 140 meters or bigger across that get close to Earth. And it's totally doable to find the vast majority of those and map where they're going.
So you say it's doable, and you're one of the people who does it, right?
Yes, I'm totally biased.
Okay. How do you do it? How do you find them?
So the way you discover an asteroid has actually not changed much at all since the first asteroid was discovered. Basically, you look at the sky, you wait a little bit, and you look at the sky again. You look for anything that is moving relative to the stars behind it. You know, back when the first one was discovered, people were taking drawings and drawing where the stars are and seeing if any stars moved relative to the other stars night to night. These days, we use CCD cameras and computer software to take the images and analyze them and look for objects that are moving to get that first cut. But basically, it's a very simple process to describe, though the implementation, once you're dealing with, you know, tens of thousands of these, gets a little bit more tricky.
Okay. So are these optical images?
So many of the asteroid surveys are optical surveys, and they're usually ground-based. So these are people at telescopes on remote mountains. A lot of them are using their kind of own expertise to decide where to point the telescope night to night. Mm-hmm. The survey I use is called NEOWISE, and it is a space-based infrared telescope. So it's kind of a slightly different beast. So we're looking at the heat that the asteroids emit.
Okay. So is it near IR, or is it very much into the thermal end?
It is thermal for asteroids, so the operating bands right now are 3.4 and 4.6 microns.
Okay, and it's in space?
It's in space.
And did you put it there, or like was this launched with exactly that goal?
That's a really great question. It was not. It's been totally repurposed. It was launched to find the coldest stars and the most luminous galaxies. It was looking for things far outside our solar system. But these days, it's been repurposed to find asteroids. It's operating well beyond its design lifetime, which is pretty cool. It's keeping tracking. The big analogy we use is that it's like a used car.
Okay.
It's got over a billion miles on its odometer these days. It's really been trucking along. It's a great little spacecraft. I like it a lot.
Okay, so we have our optical telescopes and we have our infrared systems. They're based on the ground. They're based in space. Who are the big players? Who are the agencies that are taking care of looking for asteroids?
Right now, it's overwhelmingly NASA. So there's certainly a lot of scientists all across the world who study asteroids, expertise literally all over the world, and people who use telescopes all over the world to look at these things. But when it comes to discovering near-Earth asteroids, over 95% of discoveries have been made by NASA-funded surveys. So this is primarily an American effort at this point. The five major surveys are NEOWISE, PanSTARRS, LINEAR, Catalina, and SpaceWatch.
Okay. And so it sounds like NASA is very interested in it. Why is it important to find those things?
My personal reason is that this is the only natural disaster that we have the technology to prevent. This is partly because asteroid paths are very, very predictable. We can predict where some of these objects are going to be hundreds of years in advance. And you can contrast that to, say, like an earthquake. You know, we can give probabilities on earthquake, but we can't say that an earthquake is going to happen in this part of LA on this day. We don't have that capability. We don't even have the capability to predict where a hurricane's going to be a month in advance. But we can predict exactly where these asteroids are going. And because of that, that gives us the power to do something about them if we have enough time to mount an appropriate response. So I think it's important to look for these things now so that we could do something about them if one was headed our way. And I want to be clear, you know, none of the ones we know about is headed our way. And it could be possible that we could look for all of them, we could find all of them and figure out they're all on safe trajectories as well.
Which would be a great result.
It would be awesome. It would be so, so great. Mm-hmm. It would be really low stress. It'd be just, you know, crack open a beer and, you know, cheers. It'd be very satisfying.
Hooray. But also satisfying would be knowing that environment, knowing that they're there, that they're coming if they are.
Right. And I also think that there's something interesting about the fundamental exploration of space. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times people, you know, look at all of the beautiful images that have come back from all of these space missions and think that our own solar system is very well explored, when in fact, it's not at all. And I know you know this, but one analogy I think of is that people go to the moon and back. You know, we've sent astronauts back and forth to the moon. And we think, you know, I think in the minds of most people, that region of space seems very explored. But it isn't, because in fact, a near-Earth asteroid passes through that region about once a month that we know of. So until we really find all these near-Earth asteroids, we're not going to know what's going on in our own backyard. And, you know, we could discover something amazing. We could discover places that are easy to visit with spacecraft. We could discover some places that we could send astronauts. We don't know, but they're there, and I want to find them.
And you talked about not only finding them, but finding out some details about them, their composition and so on. So what do we learn if we have a better census of the asteroids?
So the kind of go-to answers most people will talk about is that asteroids are some of the oldest material in our solar system. And so when you study the asteroid population and you get to know how many of a certain size there are, for example, you can then test models of how the planets formed or how they evolved, which is a very interesting thing in its own right. And so you really get to kind of look back in time. Some asteroids are thought to be pristine is the term, and never got, you know, changed geologically like planets did. So some of these are very, very ancient.
Okay. And how do you assess their composition remotely?
That's a great question. There's lots of ways to do that. You can send radio waves, bounce radio waves off of them and determine whether they're metallic. The technique that I use and several other groups of researchers across the world use is called thermophysical modeling. And basically what that technique is, you model the heat on their surface and you can see whether they're heating up and cooling down slowly or quickly. And you can imagine that if they're heating up and cooling down very quickly, then perhaps that's because they're made out of metal. And if they're heating up and cooling down slowly, then perhaps there's something insulating on their surface, like a layer of dust. That's kind of the very rough idea of it. And this will only probe the composition of just the surface. Mm-hmm. But it's still more information than we get from other methods. So I think it's worthwhile.
And so you get that by watching its thermal profile in infrared over time? Is that?
Basically. And you have to do a lot of, you have to pair that with models that do heat conduct across the surface, and you change the composition for various ways, and you have to see how it's spinning and the angle you're viewing it at, and you know, the details kind of get into the weeds, but that's the basic idea behind it.
Okay. And you talked about asteroids with a high metal content. How common are these?
I don't have a really good number off the top of my head.
Okay. And do we know what the metals are?
We would assume that from meteorites, that most of them are nickel and iron. There's, you know, meteorites we get from the ground that are from asteroids are either, you know, different types of rock or this kind of nickel and iron composition. Mm-hmm. And so we assume that the ones out there are the same composition, and people will back that up by looking at the spectra from them and have a lot of good evidence that way. But it's still something that we're learning quite a bit about.
Okay. Now, one of the things that's in vogue lately is to talk about using those as a source of resources. Do you see that as something that's feasible? Is that something worth doing?
I mean, it's not particularly what grabs my interest.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in finding them, but I will say that if you find more, then maybe that's more you could use for resources.
Right. Yeah, true enough. So you also talked about how you can project where these asteroids might be well into the future. Are their orbits thereby very stable?
So the orbits are incredibly predictable. Mm-hmm. And this is partly because, unlike a lot of other physical systems, they're very, very simple. Mm-hmm. The orbits of asteroids are just governed basically by gravity. And gravity, you know, depends on the masses of the planets, but we know the masses of the planets and the masses of a lot of asteroids very well. So we can figure out where these things are going due to the gravitational pull. And they're also governed to a lesser extent by things like the Yarkovsky effect, which is a really interesting kind of niche subject. The Yarkovsky effect is when you have sunlight heating up asteroids, then the warmed surface of the asteroid re-radiates out heat in the form of photons. And those departing photons, even though they're massless, carry away momentum, and they slightly change the orbit of the asteroid. And so this is a crazy, small, weird effect, but it's actually been detected on several asteroids. And I believe that the experts that predict asteroid trajectories, when they're really looking at something in detail, will incorporate that Yarkovsky effect into their super precise trajectory predictions.
Okay, so you've got incoming sunlight, and you've got outgoing thermal radiation?
Yes.
All right. Now, I think people are familiar maybe with the concept of solar sails and how that can, even the pressure of sunlight can push something. But this is a bit different, right?
This is slightly different. And I'm glad you're giving me another chance to go over that. So yeah, you have your incoming sunlight, and you can think of it in terms of kind of like the day on the asteroid. So say the incoming sunlight, you get the most sunlight at local asteroid noon. Then it takes a little while for the surface to heat up. It takes a few hours, just like on Earth. The hottest part of the day will be around 3 p.m. So at asteroid local 3 p.m., the surface is hot, and it's emitting into space these thermal photons. And it's partly because this angle between your departing photons at 3 p.m. and your incoming photons at noon is a little different that you get an imbalance. And that imbalance will very, very, very slightly change where that asteroid is going.
Okay, so there's a lag as it heats up and re-radiates. Interesting. And so
it's also interesting, Yarkovsky. I don't know if you know much history about him.
No.
But he was a Russian railroad engineer.
Okay.
And so, and this was in the early 1900s. And so it's always interesting to me to think that Yarkovsky was working on these trains, probably covered in coal dust. And he just wanted to think about like bodies in space. And he came up with this just kind of like out of the blue on his job. And I always think that's a really interesting thing to point out when you're talking about the Yarkovsky.
That is an interesting story. It's not unlike Tsiolkovsky, who himself was also kind of just a little teacher in a small town and managed to invent a way to explore the solar system.
Yeah, it's super cool. And I mean, I wonder what, you know, the train engineers today are doing when they're on their smartphones and not thinking about space.
Yeah, well, this may be a pool of untapped talent that we need to go chase.
That's right. That's right.
So the Yarkovsky effect, is that the largest perturbation on asteroids besides the gravity of the planets?
I would say generally yes for near-Earth asteroids. As you can imagine, if your asteroid is far away from the sun, it gets less sunlight and this effect dies down.
Right.
But when you're dealing with predictions of things that are close to the Earth generally, that's, again, it's a very, very small factor, but it's the next thing beyond gravity.
Sunlight pushes them out of their orbits.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's so cool that they've measured this.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely phenomenal. It's really great work done by researchers at JPL and elsewhere.
Excellent. So speaking of those orbits and predicting them, you had talked earlier about how they may come close to the Earth, and that may be a problem for us. So two things. First, what are the consequences of coming close to the Earth?
Well, usually nothing. Usually they pass by harmlessly and we can predict where they're going. Every once in a while, you know, things do hit. And in the historical record, we've seen a variety of things hit. One of the most recent ones that I think is a fascinating example is 2008 TC3. That was discovered by Richard Kowalski at the Catalina Sky Survey. And 12 hours later, it hit the Earth. And it was a very small asteroid. It didn't pose any sort of hazard to anyone. But this was the first time that astronomers spotted something in the sky, got measurements, predicted where it was going to go, saw it hit, and then picked up pieces of it. And it was this beautiful chain of events that the community worked very hard on. It was an amazing thing where astronomers and even non-scientists with telescopes all over the world were training their telescopes on this object, feeding in observations to the Minor Planet Center, which kept track of them. People were calculating orbits. I believe it was Steve Chesley and Paul Chodas at JPL who got the first position right, and it was going to impact over the Sudan. The local government was alerted. A pair of pilots diverted a plane to see it come in, which is pretty cool. And several months later, pieces were retrieved. It was an amazing chain of events.
That is a spectacular end-to-end chain.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's never happened again, but we hope it does happen again soon.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I'm a huge fan of this. I wasn't involved in any of those processes. I just, you know, can watch in awe.
Mm-hmm. But if they're larger, of course, there are potential major risks.
Certainly, certainly. And so NASA has a office at headquarters called the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. And it is headed by NASA's Chief Planetary Defense Officer, which is the coolest title.
That's quite a title.
Yeah, it's awesome. Lindley Johnson. And it's his job to prepare for any sort of event and do coordination in case something does serious happen.
Right. So imagine that we find an asteroid, we plot its trajectory, and we find that it is going to impact the Earth. How much time would we need to do something about it?
Well, I mean, it would depend on the particular response. So I would not be making any of these decisions, but I did interview Lindley Johnson for a book I wrote called Asteroid Hunters about kind of the responses that might be taken. So the first thing that you might do if the object was small is just evacuate, get out of the way. If it was bigger, you would have a variety of options. And the thing is that since asteroids themselves are so different, they can be these different compositions, they can spin at different rates. Some asteroids make full rotations in just 20 seconds. Other ones take hundreds of hours to rotate. So there's not really one size-fits-all solution. You'd really want to tailor it to the particular asteroid. And this, again, kind of feeds into the logic of why we're looking for them now. If we're looking for them now, then hopefully we're giving ourselves enough time to mount an appropriate response that's tailored to that individual situation.
Is it possible to intervene to prevent an impact?
Yes, certainly. So when I was talking to Lindley, he described that there were three main deflection mechanisms that were being considered by the broader scientific community. One is a gravity tractor. So you put something in orbit around the asteroid and you slightly tug it off its course. Mm. Another one is a kinetic impactor. You hit it with something hard, give it a good hard shove. And then the very last one, which is kind of problematic because there's a lot of variables that you can't account for, is the nuclear option. And you detonate a nuke slightly to the side of an asteroid to irradiate it, give it a shove, not like Bruce Willis blow it up, but like shove it off its course.
Okay. That is literally the nuclear option.
Yes.
that has problems, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it makes for a great movie, but as, you know, as you can surely emphasize, if you're an engineer and you're trying to solve this problem, you want something with as few variables as possible.
Yeah.
And the other two methods are a lot more controllable and predictable, and that makes them more attractive.
Okay. Have we tried any of this yet?
So not in terms of deflecting an asteroid. There was a mission called Deep Impact, which did shove an impactor into a comet, but that wasn't to move it. It was to kind of draw up a plume of dust so they could be analyzed by the scientists. So there was something sort of analogous, but not exactly.
Well, hopefully we will find these things in plenty of time and we'll spend the effort on finding them to
I hope so.
Keep them away. And in the meantime, I wish you luck at looking for them.
Thank you very much. It's a fun job.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
Okay, that was really interesting as well. Carrie Nugent, planetary scientist and podcaster. So what did you guys think about the interview?
Asteroids are just, we know they're out there, and understanding that they're not really a risk to us right now, but knowing that there are people out there tracking them, keeping a close eye on them, it's good to know. Like, I'm from an engineering background, so I'm interested in the potential of asteroid mining and
things like that.
Yeah, stuff like that. So
I suppose on that front, if that's something that you're interested in, then it must be quite good to hear that there's so many of them.
Yes.
It must actually be kind of good to also, paradoxically, kind of good to hear that they get so close.
Yeah.
Which is ironic, I think.
Yeah. Like, she talked about how there are different ideas on how to avoid impacts, get asteroids away from Earth impact, whereas the asteroid mining companies are looking to bring them closer.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. Maybe we can do a future interview and get her viewpoint on that dichotomy. Yeah. It'd be quite an interesting thing to ask her about. So what did you think about her background and her areas of interest?
I didn't know you would study asteroids like one of those things in the solar system when you take courses in astronomy in undergrad, right? You don't really go much in detail.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know a lot about asteroids until actually I did the collaborative program and you take a short course where you learn about the meteorites that come from these asteroids and you figure out actually they're not all the same.
Yeah.
And the reason why they're not all the same is there's, you know, where they come from, where the material come from, and yeah, and the potential of them impacting Earth. And the kind of meteorite actually lands, the size. Pretty interesting to see people loving asteroids the same way they love planets and exoplanets and stars.
I mean, it seems like the study of non-planetary bodies is becoming as big a study as the study of planetary bodies, which is, you know, I think very interesting. It's something that interests me, is how people can know where an asteroid comes from. You know, they can detect the composition and know this comes from another planetary body, or, you know, this is left over from the formation of the solar system, and so on and so forth. The both of you, what are your opinions on the threat of asteroids? Is that a major area of interest for you as a source of concern?
As a science communicator, I love when that happens. Think about the Chelyabinsk one, like the fact that, you know, a lot of people had videos actually reporting their sightings, and you never know where they come from, especially after learning about the Chelyabinsk one. It was a big one that came without any notice or anything. No one knew it was coming. It's coming from the sun's direction. It's not possible for us to track. it can come any moment, no matter how much we try to track. But at the same time, I mean, we have people who are working on it.
Yeah, we have people who are working on it. That's kind of interesting. What about you, Dana? Is this anything that do you spend long nights lying awake thinking about it?
No, not really. We're pretty confident that we would be able to detect anything large enough to be catastrophic. My only concern is that we would be able to actually get the technology out there to deflect it.
You know, for me, there are some issues in that we really need the development of some new kinds of technology to deal with any potential issues like that. I'm absolutely certain that such technologies can be developed. I don't know what they are, obviously, but I'm sure that there are much more efficient ways of solving that problem. Of course, that really can only come about through funding and awareness of the area. So talking to someone like Carrie is always good, seeing that sort of area of scientific interest kind of grow into its own thing is good, because that means it's more likely that that's going to come about. And so that's kind of my thoughts on it. You know, it's not something I spend all night worrying about, but, you know, it is a concern.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshdi Patel and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured John Kissy, Parshdi Patel and Dana Beaton. And our editors were John Kissy and Dana Beaton, and I am John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, and learn more about Western Worlds by going to our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. On behalf of everybody at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us. We hope you will join us next time here on Western Worlds.